Okay, sorry about that delay in getting going. What we were talking about last week was the introduction to designing a protocol so that you can get the client and the server to talk to one another with both sides knowing what the other one is saying. So the protocol design is all about setting up this language that the client and the server are going to use to communicate. And there's a variety of different sort of mechanisms that you could look at, whether it's point-to-point, multicast, and so on. Generally, most of them you'd be looking at point-to-point, TCP is the most common situation. A little bit about version control. If you get it right first time, then it makes it easier for later on. For this again, for the level that we'll get to in this assignment or in this unit, you probably won't go through too many versions anyway. So, but in real life systems, you have to pay attention to this. Okay, one thing that we'll come up against, we'll spend more time on this later. So it's just a bit of an introduction to data serialization. Because when you're moving stuff across from one side to the other, all of your programming type objects, they have to be translated into a some sort of format so that you can get them across the network as a stream of bytes. We'll come back to this later as we do more of it. Talked a little bit about the message format. What you're trying to do is to exchange messages, such as a login message from the client to the server, a request from the client to the server, and some responses which will come back. And it's all about the design of those messages that we're talking about. There are two principal formats. The one is where everything is represented as bytes. So you're not sending things in a textual readable format. You're sending them as close to the machine format as you can get. And typically, the processing code to handle that is, on the server side, it's an infinite loop waiting for messages, and you usually read the first byte gives some indication of what the message type is. So you read the first byte, do a switch to figure out which message it is, and then in the different case branches, you handle each different type of message. And the Java classes that you usually use for that are data input stream, data output stream, because they've got methods such as write int, write byte, write short that you can use for this sort of byte level formatting. Okay. Few problems with unsigned types. There are a lot of protocols around which do use unsigned types, and so sometimes you have to go through a little bit of hoops in order to be able to handle them properly. Okay. Following on from the web, which in turn followed on from email formats, one of the most popular formats nowadays is to represent everything in a character-based format in which everything becomes readable strings. So usually when this type of formatting is chosen, then the start of the message is typically a word or a line that tells you what the message type is. And in order to figure it out, you need to do string comparison mechanisms. So you read in the entire line, you look at the first word, do a string equality comparison, for example, to see if it's one of a set of words, and that will tell you what the message type is. So you normally have code that looks like read line. If the line starts with a particular word, then that's a message of one type. If it starts with a different word, it's a different message, and so on. The problems with this kind of format, well, there's several problems with it. There's lots of advantages, and the advantages is it's much easier to read the code, it's much easier to debug things because everything is in strings and you can see what's being passed around. But there are overheads because you're using strings instead of smaller sized byte messages. There's also a bunch of problems that are associated with different character sets that can occur. So most of the time in programming, you just deal with ASCII. And everyone's familiar with that as a character set. It's got all the European, it's got all the English and American letters and digits, plus a whole bunch of punctuation characters. But even with ASCII, there's a whole set of variations that are possible. ASCII was originally developed as a US standard, but the Europeans weren't completely happy with that because they have special characters like an A with a little accent above it, an acute or a grave or a circumflex, and they wanted to be able to represent those. And so what happened in Europe was that these ones that are marked in black, like the square brackets, they took those out of the ASCII character set and put some different characters in there in place of them so that they could represent the accented vowels that they wanted. So it's fine if you're sending letters, fine if you're sending numbers, but if you're sending things like backslashes or the caret symbol or curly brackets, then if you're talking to somebody with a European system, they might be interpreting them a little bit differently. So they're not completely unambiguous, those characters. As it turned out, that even with those little changes that was made to ASCII, it wasn't enough to handle all of the things that are in European scripts. So what they did is they changed it from a 7-bit format to an 8-bit format. And the 7-bit format is the standard US ASCII set. But on top of that, there's a whole bunch more added, for example, for Western Europe. So I'm not sure if you can see these very clearly, but along this top row in the second set, there's the English pound symbol. There's something which stands for a universal currency symbol. There's the Japanese or Chinese yuan symbol. Plus, in the third row, a whole bunch of these accented characters, plus a few others like this AE combination stuck together. That particular character set will handle all of Western Europe. So France, Germany, Spain, and so on. If you're talking to somebody from those countries, then using this ISO 88591 will allow you to use the characters they're familiar with. And this can make a difference, for example, if you want to send names from a client to a server and you've got some European names, then you might want to be using this particular character set. Okay. There's a little bit, even though that handles Western Europe, there's still a few problems with that because it doesn't handle Greek characters, it doesn't handle Russian characters. And so if you're data exchange needs to move Russian names around the place, you can't use this character set there. There's a whole range of these things. There's about 15 of these 88859 character sets, and they will include Israel, Eastern Europe, Northern Europe, some of the odd ones from Southern Europe as well. So there are different character sets for different parts of even Europe. If you want to deal with 7 or 8-bit stuff, then you can handle those using the PrintStream class, because that will translate, that will send individual characters as 8-bit bytes, and you can print strings, and they will come out correctly as ordinary 8-bit characters. Okay. The converse is to use a buffered reader so that you read lines, and they will be reading 8-bit characters into a Java string. Okay. There's the methods such as isAlpha. So if you want to check alphabetic characters, digit characters, and so on, all of those methods work fine with the ISO 88859 series. So if you know that you're dealing with either ASCII or with this ISO 88859, then you tend to use those two classes, buffered reader and print stream. Okay. There's a little bit of a hiccup even with that setup, in that different operating systems have different conventions for the end of line character. So if you're dealing with Unix, if you want to print a line, you print the characters and then follow that with the new line character backslash n. But that's different for MS-DOS. MS-DOS, in fact, does it probably better. What it does is it has a carriage return, which brings you back to the beginning of the line and the new line, which moves you down. So to print the line, it goes all the way across the characters, back to the beginning and down, whereas the Unix version prints the characters and then just goes down. And most Unix systems will also push it back to the beginning of the line. You don't have to take any notice of that if you're dealing with a single standalone application. But you do need to take notice of that the minute you've got a client talking to a server and they're using character-based formats. Because the client will write a line, the server will read a line, and if the client is a Unix one, sends across the backslash N, then the thing that's trying to read it, if it's an MS-DOS or Windows system, just won't be able to read it properly. Because it won't see the slash R, so it won't see it as an end of line. So what you'd do normally, again with standalone applications, if you really wanted to know which one was which, there's a property called line.separator, and that's a string which is either slash N or slash R slash N. But that's no good for the networking things, because you want it, whatever operating system the client and server are, you want them to have the same convention, not a different one. So what you have to do, what it basically means is you can't use println, because println looks at the line separator, and if you're under Windows, it'll print slash R slash N. If you're under Unix, it'll print slash N. So if you're trying to use a networking mechanism, you have to agree upon a particular convention. And what's come from the email conventions is that every line will be finished with that pair, slash R, slash N. Okay. So it came from the email mechanism, and that's been adopted by nearly every internet protocol that's character-based since then. So what will happen is, if you're running a client under MS-DOS or under Windows and you use println, then it will work okay. But if you run that same client under Unix, it won't work okay, because it'll be sending just the slash N and not the two characters. Okay. So in order to avoid that, what you basically need to do is just get rid of println. And instead of print line, use print and explicitly put the slash R slash N every time you want to finish a line. Okay. So it's a simple thing to do, but you just have to remember to do it. On the reading side, there's no problem, because the Java read line in buffered reader, that's set up so it'll recognize any combination of slash R slash N, so it'll read okay. Okay, what that means in practice is if you've got a Java client and a Java server, then because buffered reader handles any combination, it will work. But as soon as you start swapping languages, supposing you have a Java client and a C server and you send a message, then it won't work unless you explicitly do things like print slash R slash N. So just in general, if you stick to not using print line, then you'll be right for every situation. Okay. All right. So that's the sort of hiccups you have to go through if you're looking at European type character sets. But if you've got a Japanese application and you want to send a Japanese name across to it, then it's not going to work even with the ASCII or 8859. And for that, you have to switch to Unicode. Okay. That gives you all of the hieroglyphics that you need for most of Japanese, Korean, and Chinese. It's also got the Thai language in there. Vietnamese is okay, don't need to worry. It's got the Jawi scripts and lots of other different things in there. So by using Unicode, then you can send any sort of textual data that's currently represented. This is partly easy within Java because Java internally uses Unicode already. So if you look at a Java character, it is a 16-bit character using the Unicode set. So within your Java programs, you can handle all these different languages. All you got to figure out is how you get it across the network to the other side. Okay, so if you know that they're 8-bit characters, so there are about 60,000 or so of these things. Almost all of the 60,000 need to be the 8-bit format. But the ASCII subset and the ISO 8859 subset, they sit right at the beginning and they're 8-bit things anyway. So if you know that you just want to send European names, then you can still carry on using print stream and read line. But as soon as you get to these Chinese or Korean characters, then what will happen if you try and use these print stream and read line is that they take the 16-bit character, chuck away the top 8 bits, and give you only the bottom 8 bits. So they will get it wrong as soon as you try and send a general Unicode character right across. So if you know that you're going to deal with Unicode, then you don't use those classes. You have to switch to a different set instead. Okay. There are some. There are, for example, within data output stream, there's the write char method. And if you give it a Unicode character, then it will write it as 2 bytes. And then on the reverse side, data input stream, read char will also read 2 bytes in as a character. Okay. There are some methods called write UTF and read UTF. UTF is one of the standard ways of sending of writing Unicode characters in a slightly compressed form. So what UTF does is, if it has to be 16-bit, it leaves it as 16-bit. But where it can squash it down to 8 bits, it will do so. So that's a sort of just a fallback saying that currently most of the stuff that's sent around is still the ASCII stuff. So rather than wasting 2 bytes on ASCII characters, the UTF will squash them down to just 1. That will change in future. The estimates are, I think, 40% of the web stuff will be in Chinese in 5 years' time. So the UTF won't matter quite so much. But UTF is one of the standard ways of serializing a string so that you can send it across a network. There is a little bit of a problem using that in that the Java version of the UTF format is not quite the standard form. Most of the time it'll work okay with C versions and so on, but a couple of characters it will get wrong. So it's not quite the ideal way of doing it. So you can get away with using write UTF. I think the only character that really gets wrong is the null byte. So as long as you aren't sending nulls, then you can use write UTF and read UTF. But as soon as you want to send a null character, then it'll get it incorrect. Okay. If you switch outside of Unicode, things can get a lot more complicated because before Unicode came along, there were lots of people working on different character formats, different ways of writing Japanese, different ways of writing Chinese, and so on. And it's just a big sort of mess, basically, of all the different possibilities that are there. I've got a listed there about a dozen of them, but it goes into the tens. There are lots of these things. Okay. How you can handle it, there are mechanisms within Java to handle all these things. And what you need to do to handle those is you create an input stream reader. So you have some sort of input stream, and you know that what's in that input stream will be characters according to some encoding. What you do is you wrap them around in an input stream reader and give as a second parameter that actual encoding that's going to be used. And what that will do is if the format of the message is UTF-8, that will decode them so that you can read ordinary characters and all of the messy stuff will be done for you. And similarly with the output stream writer, you can put that second parameter, UTF-8 again, and that will encode them correctly to send across. Okay, so it's easy if you're using ASCII. It gets a bit more complicated as soon as you go into these international character sets. As it happens, even Unicode is not quite good enough to handle all languages. There's a bit of a compromise that was made in Unicode, and that was to say that within the Korean, Japanese, and Chinese languages, there are some characters which appear roughly identical. And rather than have separate versions, they squash them all together. That's not a problem if you're just dealing with Chinese, not a problem if you're just dealing with Korean, and it's fine if you're just dealing with Japanese. But if you have a Japanese client and a Chinese server, then what might be sent from the Japanese client might be the Japanese character would be interpreted as the Chinese character on the other end. So in multi-language situations, Unicode doesn't quite get it right either. So there's another character set called ISO 10646, and that is a 32-bit character set, which is big enough for everything. So it's got millions and millions of possibilities. And not only does it solve all these sort of duplications of the Asian characters, people have done things like put Egyptian hieroglyphics. If any of you follow Star Trek, there was the alien language called Klingon made up for Star Trek. Well, that's in there somewhere too. Okay. As far as I know, Lord of the Rings, the Elvish languages from Lord of the Rings, they haven't made it there yet, but there's enough room for them all. Okay. So you can have lots. But unfortunately, in terms of programming, there is no programming support in any language that I know of as yet. So it's the answer to everything except how to write programs, because nobody's done them. Okay. All right, where does that get you to? We'll just try a fairly simple one, a small file transfer protocol, what that would look like. So what we want to be able to do with this simple version of FTP is to be able to list some files, transfer a file from one side to the other, and that's about it. First of all, let's look at a non-client server program. So we'll just have it treated as though it's a standalone application and look at the changes that you need to make to turn it into a networked one. So if you want a program that can list files in the current directory, be able to change directories, be able to move a file around, then the pseudo code would look something like read a line from the user. As long as you haven't hit end of file, then you've got a valid line, do something with it. If the user has typed in dir, for example, then you want to list the directory back to them. If they've typed in change directory, CD, and given some directory name, then try and change. If it succeeds, print some information, otherwise say no such directory. Else, a third type of message, if the line is copy with a file name and the file exists and can be read, then copy it to somewhere, otherwise complain about it. And the final type of message, if the line is quit, then quit. Otherwise, you've got a message that you can't understand, complain about it, and then go back around the loop by reading the next line from the user. Okay, so that would be the pseudocode for a standalone application. The easy way of doing it, again, would be if it's non-distributed. So you've got this user interface code, which is not a big deal in here. It's reading lines from the user, printing lines back to the user. It's got a file access component. Things like change directory uses the file system, copy a file uses the file system, so there's reads and writes and some sort of file access that's going on. As soon as we make it a client-server system, what we want to do then is to separate out the user interface and the file access. So if we're doing a FTP type program, listing files on a remote machine, changing directory on a remote machine, copying from a remote machine, and presenting the information back to a user, then we have a user interface component over on the client side. All of the file system access is over on the server side, and there's this bunch of stuff that's in the middle to handle the network I/O. Okay. And that bit in the middle will be done using sockets, and is also where you need to define the protocol that you're using to get the messages to and from both sides. So if we assume all files at server end, and we make it simple, we're just transferring ASCII files, so we don't have to worry about any language complexities, then what it would look like from the client side would be, we've got some client I/O, read line from the user, just the end of file check. It's the same sort of decoding mechanism. If the user has typed in DIR, then we want to list that directory. Now, this is now going to be a little bit more complicated, because in order to list the directory, you have to send a message across to the server, read the reply from the server, and then present it back to the user. Okay. So this step here is going to involve some network access. So this is one that's actually going to be doing the network programming. The next type of message, again, if the message from the user was change directory, then you want to send across to the server the change directory message. If it's successful, whatever reply you got, you print that back to the user, otherwise complain, and so on. If the line was copy, if what the user typed was copy, then we want to initiate this file transfer from the server to the client. Otherwise, the line was quit, then just give up on the client side. Okay. And all of those italicized ones involve that networking communication. Okay. There's an advantage to treating it in this kind of way, of trying to separate the user interface part from this networking part. If we've written the code that will do change directory and written the code that will do copy file, then you can muck around with the rest of the user interface without needing to change those parts of it. So, for example, this is currently a command line type interface. It's reading lines from the user, so reading directly from the keyboard, printing messages back to the console. You could change all of that user interface side to, say, a graphical user interface without needing to change the communications with the server. So if you've got something with buttons that are showing and it's got a change directory button, if you click on that button and a file has been selected, then the change directory code is still the same networking code, even though the UI has changed. What happens when you get an answer back is you update labels that are showing on the screen, update directory lists that are showing on the screen, and so on. And if it's showing a list of the directory, well, after the change directory is made, if you send another network message, list directory, then you can update the display there. So once you've got the networking stuff there, if it's properly encapsulated, then you can change user interfaces without having to change the network stuff. So going back to the figure there, what it's nice to be able to try and do is to split the code up in that kind of way, so that the stuff that doesn't involve networking is all in the left-hand side of the client, the stuff that does involve it in the right-hand side, and vice versa over on the server. This is, we'll talk about this later, as a design pattern called the client half, or sorry, the half object. And although I just put it in terms of changing the user interface, one of the other options here is that you can change the networking code without changing the user interface. And this will essentially be the difference between assignment one and assignment two. Assignment one, you'll be designing all of the UI, the client-server communication, and whatever the backend is, using sockets for this network communication. For assignment two, if you got it structured okay, this part will be left completely unchanged. The file system access will be left completely unchanged. And instead of using sockets in between the two, you'll switch that for RPC or web services or SOAP or whatever it is that you want to use. So by splitting the bits on both on client and server, you give yourself the potential of being able to change part of it without having to muck around with the rest. Okay, so we need to define how the client and the server are going to talk. So you need the description of the protocol. And normally you just start off with something informal and then tighten it up until it becomes unambiguous if possible. So informally, you might be sending from the client to the server a directory request, and what you want is a list of files to come back in some format. The other message you want to send from the client is to change directory. And the messages that should come back, there'll be some bit of logic that occurs over on the server side of actually doing the change directory. It will need to send messages back, send an error if it's failed, the new directory if it's succeeded, get a file. If the file can be read, if it can't, then you send an error. If it can, you send the contents of the file. And a quit message, maybe some sort of response. The client quits, the server quits. Okay, so once you've got a rough idea of the messages, you then tighten it up and we'll say, for example, that we're going to use a text format. And then you need to say, if it's going to be text, what character set you're using. And so you say something like 7-bit US ASCII means that we can use square brackets, whatever we want to use. Okay. You need to specify whether it's case sensitive or insensitive. So does it matter whether it's uppercase or lowercase? It's easier to write the code if it's case sensitive, because you can just do straight string comparisons. A lot of the protocols, though, are case insensitive. So, for example, HTTP, the GET command can be in uppercase, lowercase, any mixture. And when you're decoding messages, it becomes a little bit more complicated, because when you're comparing strings, you have to ignore case. There is a method within the Java string class. There's equals, which will do case-sensitive comparison, and there's equals ignore case, which will do case-insensitive stuff. So it makes just a little bit of a difference to your programming, whether it's case-sensitive or insensitive. So you have to specify it. The first message will consist of a sequence of lines. And the first word on the first line describes the message, and all the other words are message data. Okay. All words are separated by one or more tab or blanks. Okay. Again, you'll often see this. A lot of protocols will say one or more white space. So if it does say one or more, you can't just look for a single blank. You have to look for one or more blanks. So you have to be able to skip any embedded spaces. And often, tabs or blanks. So tabs or space. So the freer this format is described, the harder it makes the programming, but it makes it, in order to figure out what's going on, but it makes it more flexible, I guess, for users to have. Okay, so all words are separated by tabs or blanks, but we'll exclude the new line, and then you have to say what the new line separator is going to be, carriage return line feed. Once you've said the format, you can then talk in more detail about what the messages are going to be. So send, D-I-R, case sensitive, and we chose an uppercase. So the three characters, D-I-R, which will be carriage return line feed terminated. So if that message is sent, then a list of files, one per line, carriage return line feed at the end of each one. And then you have to somehow say how the end of the list has finished. If it's a list of strings, the two major possibilities are give a count first off or give something like a blank line at the end. So this is just saying there's going to be a blank line. Carriage return line feed, carriage return line feed to finish that. Send CD with some white space in between. Can be any amount of white space because the spec said so. And what's going to happen on the server? Change directory, send an error message if it fails, succeeded, plus directory name if succeeded. Okay. Get file, send error if it failed. If it succeeded, send the contents of the file. And again, you don't know how big the file's going to be. Files can have blank lines in them. So it's not easy to find a terminating character for it. So send the number of lines first off so you know how many times to read. Okay. And send quit, close connection. So there'll be some common code which will probably occur on both sides. These constants, all the words that are going to be used, CD, dir, get, error, succeeded, quit, all those words have to be understood identically by both client and server, so you could put them in some sort of common class for that. Carriage return line feed, if you define it as a constant, then you can just carry on using that constant and you don't have to worry about ever then getting it wrong. And whatever port they're going to be talking on, because they have to agree to talk on the same port. Okay, the server code will look something like this is not quite complete. Anyway, you need to set up, to run a server, you need to set up a server socket. You need that socket, server socket, to be listening on the port. When a client request comes in, you have a socket handler for that client request, and that will be looking at all these different messages. So start off by creating a new server socket, and that will be listening on that known port, catch the exceptions if they occur, and give up if you can't listen at all. Go into the infinite loop of listening for a new connection by accepting a connection on the server socket, and that will return you a socket connection to the client. If we want a multi-threaded one, then we have a socket handler running in its own thread. That will take this incoming socket and start the new thread. So we've got a multi-threaded server running there. The socket handler for that extends thread. The constructor just takes that incoming socket and saves it in a local field. What else has that got in here? So we've got the incoming socket. We need to keep track of which directory the client thinks that we're in, or we actually have to keep track of that directory. So, because the client will be sending change directory messages. So we'll start off by initializing it to say you're in the current directory. So the client directory, where we currently think it is, the current directory dot. Okay, we're handling ASCII, so we can use buffered readers and print stream. So you get the input stream, get the output stream, and wrap them up in the right kind of reader and print stream. That allows you to read lines, and it's reading lines of ASCII characters. So we can do things like reader.readline, and that will give the message that's coming from the client. Then you have to start decoding that message. And what we're saying is the protocol said that the line starts with the word. So start decoding it by saying, does that string start with the change directory, or does it start with the directory listing, or does it start with get, or does it start with quit? Okay. So decode all of those messages, and then for each message, change directory request, handle the directory request, handle the file transfer request, quit will break out of that infinite loop, and the client or that socket can then be closed. Okay, so the incompleteness is that I haven't actually done the file transfer stuff in here, so that's missed out. Okay. Otherwise, if it's any other message that's been sent by the client, if you can't decode it into the known ones, you send back an error message saying don't know what the message was. Okay, what do we got in here? Take the line. What we want to do with some of these lines, if it's a change directory request, then it's CD, some white spaces, and then the directory you're changing to. So you want to lose the CD and all of those white space at the beginning. So just got a convenience method, lose prefix, gets rid of the CD, gets rid of the white space, and should just leave the directory you're changing to. And similarly, if it, where have we got it? We don't need, to do any decoding for a dir, because dir was just the three letters by itself on the line. Okay, so, so the lose prefix is just take that prefix away from the beginning by doing a substring. So the substring is the rest of the string, and trim is a string command that will get rid of white space before and after. Okay. Then the actual logic of the thing, change directory request, would be from the current directory change to a different directory, and you can do that by creating a file object which takes current directory and the directory you're trying to change to. You can do a check on that to see if it is a directory. You want to change it to the, to that new directory, reassign client dir. And if that works okay, you send back a succeeded message. So this is the print stream, out.print, send the succeeded message, send the new directory that you changed to, and finish it with a carriage return line feed. Okay, because every line has to finish with that CRLF. Okay. So that's the change dir. If something goes wrong with the change directory request, if it's not a new directory, for example, send back an error message saying can't be done. The directory request, if you're asked for a dir, then you want to create a string of file names or an array of file names. The directory command list will return a string array. If it's not a directory, for example, then you'll get null, in which case send back an error. Otherwise, what we want to do is print all the names, and there's a mistake in there because it doesn't say, the protocol said the number of files has to there's a blank line at the end, wasn't there? Sorry. Yeah, so the protocol for directory listing said list all the files one per line and then end with a blank line at the end. Okay. So the for loop runs through that array, prints each file name, terminated by carriage return line feed, and once that is over, sends another carriage return line feed to give the blank line at the end. Okay. Any questions on the server side? Let's take a break for 5 minutes and then do the client stuff.